we begin and we continue tonight. What we're going to try to do is that even though we are going through Megillah and there's a long story, as you notice, what we try to do is like each evening, each like week, we're trying to make it that it's one cohesive idea, right? So we've spent, you know, we had an introduction, then we talked about the family and the tragedy, then we talked about Naomi, the journey, and Ruth, and we talked about the Orpah aspect of it. Last week we talked about Ruth being part of the family legacy. And this week we're going to talk about the return. Okay, so each week's got a certain theme rather than it being just, you know, okay, we go up to a certain amount of psukim. We may, this week, depending on the timing, have a chance to go a little further, depending into Perek Beis. But let's see how it goes. So we have the last part of Perek Aleph is really ahead of us, which is the last four psukim, which is your test to Chof Beis. This is on page 3. And once again, even though there's only a finite amount of words, so, you know, we're being told a message, and, you know, how much could you possibly contain in four sentences? And the answer is a whole lot. So, because we need to reference it in terms of what it's telling us, in relationship to itself, in relationship to the context, in relationship to the Megillah as a whole, in the relationship to Tanakh. So the more we get a sense of its greater relationship, the more that it actually is telling us. So here, let's start at the very beginning. Vatailachna shtehem, and they both went ad vo'ana beis lechem until they came to Bethlehem. Vayihika vo'ana beis lechem vatohom kol ha'ir aleihem vatomarna hazos nami. And as they arrive, all the city arrive, and the way they translated it is, and they say that all the city was astir concerning them. Vatohom kol ha'ir, there was a, you know, a habab, and they said, is this Naomi? That's her welcome back. And so there's a few things to notice over here, and that is verbs quickly. Yeah. We're focusing on and who's walking over here? It is both of them. Okay, you've noticed that up till now in the Megillah we've seen a lot of single led groups. We've seen Elimelech, that there was a man who came from Beis Lechem and his family came with him, but he was really the instigator. He was the protagonist of that story. Then we saw when Naomi was returning, she went and her daughters-in-law came with her. But this is the first time we're seeing in the Megillah, now we're seeing a unit, which is a very interesting idea. That means to say that whatever the struggles that Ruth and Naomi had up till now, and the whole conversation, there could have been a lot of tension in the air, they continue with a unified or united plan. So that's what the Megillah is telling us over here. It sounds similar to another instance, interestingly enough. Where else in Tanakh you have this idea where there's a question as to a mission and then a unity in that mission thereafter? Exactly. So I think by Akedah you see a similar kind of thing where, you know, Yitzhak's wondering to his father, you know, what's going on over here? Where is the Sela Ola? And Avram says, we'll find it. And Yitzhak realizes at the moment that something is afoot, depending on how much he knows, not clear. But nonetheless, they both went together. So the common mission is shared over here as they continue, which is something beautiful, despite the whole discussion that's been had up till now. So now let's think about this even more carefully. So what's going on over here in this episode? You know, I think that there's no question for those of you who did some Harlem Renaissance reading. That there's a beautiful book called And Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. And actually I had the opportunity of studying it in one of my college courses. Absolutely fabulous book. Very, very interesting. And I have no doubt that the first chapter, which is essentially actually the beginning and ending scene of the entire book, is patterned after this pasuk. I have no doubt in my mind. I just want to read for you. Just two paragraphs, just to get a sense of the mood of what you can imagine. What she's drawing out of this pasuk. Seeing the woman, so we're talking about a woman called Janie, who's moved away from her city and her growing up, and she got married to a man who's much younger than her, and now she's returning by herself. And this is the beginning scene of the book, and this is how she describes it. Seeing the woman as she made them seeing the woman as she was made them remember the envy they had stored up from other times. So they chewed up the back parts of their minds and swallowed with relish. They made burning statements with questions and killing tools out of laughs. It was a mass cruelty. A mood had come alive. Words walking without masters, walking all together like harmony in a song. What's she doing coming back here in them overalls? Can't she find a dress to put on? Where's that satin dress she left herein? Where's all that money her husband took and died and left her? What's that old 40-year-old woman doing with her hair swinging down her back like a young girl? Where she left that young lad or boy that she went off with? Thought she was going to marry? Where he left her? And all these questions are being had on the patios of these houses as she's approaching, and then as she arrives, they all greet her. And this is the description of Janie's return to her town in Florida, and the town sort of that on the one hand there's a sense of pity and there's a sense of scorn, and I think you can sort of see that all over here in the word Hazos Naomi. Is this really Naomi? Think what's going through their minds. What the Midrash, the Yalkut Shimoni says, is what are they remembering? They're remembering all her wealth. They're saying, look, we knew who she was. We knew that somebody used to bring the paper to her door, you know, with a cup of warm milk every morning. We know what she used to live like, and now she's coming back in them overalls. That's the picture that they're conjuring up. Hazos Naomi, is this really Naomi? Rav Bachrach says that on the one hand, it's even worse than that, because remember, not only did she leave and now she's looking a whole lot worse, but she really was their hope. She could have been the person to have saved them. Remember, the hardships were coming along, economic difficulty. She was the aristocracy of the time, and she left in that face. Now, not only do they look at what happened and what changed, they look at her and there's a sense of scorn. How could you? Like, how could you even come back here when you left us in the lurch? Hazos Naomi, is this really Naomi? As she walks back in. Very sad. Notice, by the way, that what do they not comment on?
Ruth.
They don't comment on Ruth, right? Isn't it interesting? That, you know, is what? Is Ruth, you know, chopped liver? What's going on over here? Are they not commenting on Ruth? Or maybe they are by saying Hazos Naomi as well. Maybe part of the commentary on Naomi is, and now look what she's got with her. That might be part of what their score. Look, she's coming back with somebody who's not even part of our circle, our culture, which is part, even adds to it, even perhaps even a more sad note. So this is the town as she enters it, and she responds to them. She is actually quite upfront about her feelings. She says in 2 Psukim, a short soliloquy, "V'tomer lehen, al tikrano li Naomi." Don't call me Naomi from the words. What's the word Naomi mean?
Sweet
or pleasant, right? Don't call me Naom, as in pleasant. Pleasant. Kareno li mara, call me bitter. Ki heimar shakai li ma'od. God has really been bitter to me. I went as I was full, but I returned when I was empty. Why do you call me Naomi? Vashem onavi, Hashem testified against me. Vashakai heirali, and a God was so to speak evil to me. That's the way Naomi responds. And you know, okay, so we're gonna have to understand why it is that she's using this particular name of Hashem. Shakai is usually the name that we use to demonstrate Hashem's withholding. Okay, so the first time it's used in that the Torah uses it is, as the Midrash explains, is when there is the world is in an evolutionary creative process, and Hashem says Shakai Sheomar La'olamai Dai. It is an acronym of Hashem said enough. Let the creation stop at a static point and no further. Let, so to speak, give the space for humanity. That's where Shakai is used. We have to think about what the connotations of it are in this context. There's a lot going on over here. First of all, just to understand the words. What does it mean? Milea, she's full when she left?
Children.
Full children, wealth, everything, a whole life that she came with, and she came empty of all that. The word ana, right, that Hashem, ana could mean answered, but in this case, Rashi actually says that it means, you know, when it says lo sa'ane bereacha eid shaker, don't testify, don't bear false witness. It's like she's saying God is testifying against me by my status. There's something that God's speaking against what I did or what my family did. Now, notice something interesting. Why is she repeating herself? Is there anything she's really changed in pasuk chaf and pasuk chaf aleph? It's almost like she's saying the same thing twice, emphatically, right? Look what she's saying. Right? Okay, so let's start. So in the first one, she says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. because Hashem was bitter to me. Yeah, and then what you and you're saying, she's explaining by saying, because I left full and I'm coming back empty. So that's why. And then she reemphasizes, but it's almost exactly the same thing. Why are you calling me Naomi? Hashem was testified against me. But nonetheless, it may be poetic. It may be just that she's just emphasizing in a poetic nature how negative it was. She is adding in the empty and the full. But other than that, it doesn't seem this too much different from what she's actually saying. Fascinatingly enough, right? Now, so the Malbim says that no. In fact, there is something which is being said which is different. And that is in the first pasuk, she's just saying the following. She's saying that objectively speaking, in on an objective scale, I've had a tough life. I'm coming in here. I don't have assets. I don't have family. I don't have a support system. Hashem gave me a hard life. Shakai Hemarli. Hashem gave me a very hard life. In the second pasuk, she is now saying that not only do I have an objectively sad and difficult existence, I have a relatively sad existence. And that is that it's all right. You know, maybe if my whole life had been living like this, then I would never have known otherwise. If I'd lived my whole life and it had been always on the breadline, okay, you know, I didn't know what it was like to have a family. Okay, you know, meaning that it's a very difficult life, but it's perhaps even more painful in the second pasuk. She's saying, says the Malbim, because ani melei ala halachti, because it's in the back of my mind, I always have an image of what it really was like, of what the different lifestyle I led was, and now it's even worse for me. It's even more bitter. It's even more painful. It's almost like she's arguing, and this is you know, she's almost like building up a climax over here, which is that perhaps it is even worse to have been so well off, to have had such blessing, and now to suffer so much. Do you see that? Mm-hmm. I mean, not only is it a tough life, but it's so much worse because of the good.
So not better to have loved and lost and never.
Exactly,
loved at all.
Exactly, and that's exactly the point. So just to, and by the way, so Terry, where's that from? Any literary people out there?
Later than
Shakespeare. No, same era, Victorian. Very good. It is Alfred Lloyd Tennyson in a poem called In Memoriam. So it's very famously quoted, 'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. Alfred Lloyd Tennyson. And just to understand, the poem In Memoriam, which is an incredibly beautiful beautiful classic. It's huge. It's almost a book. It was written. He was a poet Royal about a friend, Alfred Henry Hallam, who died as a young man, and he wrote a poem called In Memoriam about his friend who had died early. That's what the poem is about, and it explores all types of things. He explores evolution. Remember, he's writing in the 1850s. So this is when Darwin started to publish. So you start seeing very fascinating things there. In and amongst that poem, that's when he makes this argument. And I think that maybe the Megillah, from a satirical standpoint, from an outside standpoint, is questioning exactly that point over here, which is she's building up and she's saying it's worse because of this. And maybe the Megillah is leaving the question mark, the perennial question mark at the end, is maybe not. Right? Maybe there is value in that relationship, irrespective of that. Now, that's the question that's left in our minds after this very painful conversation that she's presenting in front of us. Just like that's exactly in that direction, as you're saying. Let's take it a little further. If you see in the next pasuk, there's an interesting word which keeps coming up, and that is, in fact, it's already come up, and that is Vatoshav Naomi Rivarus Moavia Kalasai Moav. They returned. Shavam Istei Moav returned from the fields of Moav. Vehema Bol Mila Bezlechem Etchilas Ketzirus Orim. They came there to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. We're going to have to keep the timeline in grain for later on, why that's so relevant. But what's the important word over here?
Vatashav,
right? Do you notice that it says that she returns with her daughter who is returning from Moab? So that could also, which is interesting, because you would actually say out of them, who's really returning? Only Naomi is really returning, but it seems like the Megillah is emphasizing that not only is Naomi returning, but Ruth is returning. So for Naomi, it might be a geographical return. For Ruth, it's a spiritual return. There's a return to self, if you want to put it on a. She's doing that inner journey. She's finding who she is on this journey, which is what Ruth is doing over here.
Why are you assuming it's
But I understand that, but isn't it referring to the main person in that sentence, which would still be Naomi?
Very possibly, very possibly. I just think that it already, once it says, Atoshav Naomi, and then it adds in, Virus Moavio Hashava Mistei Moav, I think that is referring to the last subject of the sentence, which is would be Rus in this case. That's the way I would read it, but I could hear how it could be read otherwise. It just then it would essentially be describing Naomi twice with that. So that's the reason I read it this way. But I hear your point is well taken, Barbara. But what seems to be over here is what some of the Mephoshim point out, some of the later Mephoshim point out, is that maybe it actually is thematic in the sense that not only is she returning geographically and Rus perhaps in her own spiritual journey, but maybe it's also related to the word teshuva as well.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe if you think about it over here, when we talked about famine beforehand, we talked about localized famine and how the family sort of just said, okay, adios, you know, thank you so much. We'll find our grain elsewhere, and then they left. What essentially they're doing was they were saying, well, look, you know, God's trying to speak to us, but we're not really willing to engage in that conversation. We're just going to, you know, find another gas station to draw from. So what Naomi's doing over here is, on behalf of the family who really weren't prepared to reckon with the economic situation being a religious situation, she's now actually has to take the bull by the horns and say, Hashav Mistei Moav. She's taking that recognition. She's reckoning with that passage which the family didn't. And that's very, 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 that's very, very courageous, because she wasn't the one who had to. She wasn't the one who had to. It was the family who had to, and they didn't. She ends up doing that. In fact, what's most remarkable about this entire conversation is many times we've been in situations where we have perhaps put our foot in the wrong direction, or made a wrong calculation. But in the end of the day, it's easier to let it sort of blow over, right? It's much easier to let it all blow over, and then when everybody's forgotten, then sort of just come back into business. What seems to be happening over here is that she is not only she's not letting it blow over, she's addressing it. And when they ask her that challenging question, "Hazos Naomi," what is she saying? She's actually responding, and she's saying, you know what, you're right. God gave me a tough portion to deal with. He gave me a tough portion. You know why? Because of Hashava Mistei Moav, there was a implication of our leaving. Can you imagine anybody doing that? Do you know how many millions of dollars must be spent a year of people trying to defend their positions, even though that they're wrong, and they know that they're wrong? Do you know how much people will spend their lives trying to justify a position they made? This is what the courage of what we see the Naomi is doing over here.
Maybe
in fact,
connects with the word anah and testifying.
Interesting.
God is testifying against what I did.
Good. Yeah. So that's what the Maamnoa says. Exactly that point is, if you want to take it in that direction, what she's saying is she is justifying God, so to speak, which is even more than you can. Than you know, like we like to point fingers and sort of work out everybody else's cheshbonos. The way the Gemara looks at it, the way the Torah looks at it, is that the only person who can really, really know what's going on with us is ourselves, because we are the only ones who really know what all the different parts of the equation were and what the real struggles were. And what she's saying is, Ashaka, Ashakai, hey Marley, look, you know what? He did. He gave us. She's essentially saying, in a certain sense, I accept it. There's something to that which I accept.
That's what I want to ask you before, with the word Shakai. I don't. This is why I'm not sure if I'm right or not. But if she was just saying she was being punished, in general, she might have used Elohim as justice. But she's actually saying she's seeing that the kindness that God did, because she really deserved more. They did wrong, and she's accepting that.
Interesting. That's interesting. So you're saying the Shakai is that Hashem's holding back from even more.
Right.
I haven't come to piece of yet of how that word works and that name works specifically. That's a definitely a distinct possibility of how she's looking at that justice. This is a very brave action that Naomi's taking on those many fronts. On the front in terms of the fact that she's not one ounce defensive. She's accepting of what they're saying. She's intensifying what they're saying. And not only does she intensify it, she actually invites God into that picture as well. So she's making this a theological crisis, and she's accepting, which is really very unusual. Karen.
Okay, on a much simpler note, as usual,
No, no.
I read this, and I'm reading this for really the first time, I see a very strong woman. When I see return, I see her as making a statement that she and Ruth are one. She is returning with her. They are a team. They are together. And it empowers her. I think it's empowering. The two of them together as one. What she does, she's going with her. She is her person. She's her family. I think it's a very powerful statement.
There's no question. You're right. What she's doing is very powerful. What's the trouble is that what everybody else is looking at is not. So that's exactly the end of this pasuk is. Why is it talk about over here the Katsir Chitim? Because of our body. Our body's cutting season. What's going on over here is that Rav Bachruch actually says that what really happens is they all walk in, they all look at them, they all notice them, and they return to the fields. Mm-hmm. Right? So meaning to say, look, oh, is this Naomi? Oh, that's so interesting, and it's a headline for a day or two, and everybody starts talking about it after supper in the kitchen, and then it's the parak ends with the words Vehema bol beis lechem b'tichilas kitziras chitim and tachlis. Let's get back to the fields, right? Which seems to be the emphasis of the parak is that you know the heroism, the courage that you've seen, and the unity is not really you know okay. That's very interesting, and they haven't even related to Rus at this point in time. And they kind of, you know, it just becomes a spectacle, and they carry on with their lives. And we should know that Naomi, as we're about to see, does have relations in the city, but nonetheless, they're not apparent from this conversation. So this is kind of how they left, and you know, you're left to this parak with you know the screen dimming, and the two of them are standing on the side of the road, right? So after all the habab and everything else, you know, they're sort of standing in the same place they were, and everybody's sort of taken what they want from the conversation, and now everybody's back to their regular lives on Katsir Chitim. I do want to point out that we should keep in mind that the chronology of this Megillah is kept in terms of agricultural seasons. Okay, so there's no timeline in terms of times of year, but it's kept in terms of the agricultural cycle. At this point in time, we're at the barley festival. We had famine beforehand, famine to barley cutting to, and we're going to move on towards the Katsir Chitim later on in the Megillah. That's going to be our time frame. We're going to think about why the Megillah frames itself in terms of grain, which is just an interesting way of sort of demarcating that axis of time, interestingly enough. If you want to know what time of year this is, usually barley is coming is becoming fresh around Pesach time, so we're talking early spring. Okay, but the it doesn't tell us that. It's just telling us the actual actual agriculture. So let's dive straight in. This leads us now to where they're left. So the beginning of Perek Bez, let's see how much we can get done in this Perek just over the next little bit. So first of all, we told the following. And even though we didn't have any welcome party or any housewarming parties or anything else, but really Naomi Moida Isha, there was somebody that she was connected to. Ish Gibor Chayil Mimishpachas Elimelech Ushmo Boaz. He was this man from Elimelech's family, and his name was Boaz. Just to get a sense of how this works, Rashi explains this explicitly, but the family tree is the following. Let's just see where we put it. Oh, bottom of page 15. Okay? The way it works is the following. Nachshon ben Aminadav. We know Nachshon ben Aminadav because he jumped into the sea, and he is Elisha, and he is Miriam's... One second, how does it work? Yeah, it is Miriam's... Nachshon married... How does it work? It's a Gnostics parasha. There's a connection there between the Moshe Rabbeinu family. Kalev married Miriam. Okay. Yeah. So no, there's another connection over there, but
Nachshon's married to Miriam.
I'm trying to work out if that's it or not. I think it is. Nachshon is married because okay, we'll have to. Yeah, you check out the brother, and that's why the Torah emphasizes in Parshas Vayera. Okay, so be it as it may, there's Nachshon ben Aminadav. Nachshon ben Aminadav has three children or three sons, and they are Elimelech. Descendants, and they are Elimelech, Salmon, and Shalmon and Ploni Almoni, or Salmon and Ploni Almoni. Okay, so Elimelech has two children, Machlon and Kilion, and Salmon has a son called Boaz, which means that Boaz in his relationship to Elimelech is a nephew. Okay, so that's is his relationship, which means that in fact He is not the closest relative. He is the second closest relative, because if we can find this fellow called Pliny Almoli, then we'll be able to have one step closer, because he's actually the same generation as Elimelech. So what we're being told now over here is that there is this person who is a Gibor Chayil, which is a very strong and very positive description of a person, who is from the family of Elimelech, and his name is Boaz. Notice over here in the parentheses for a moment that the parentheses over there indicate what's called a kri uksiv. There are a lot of them in the Megillah, which means to say that it's written one way and it's read another way. But always when you have a read one way and written another way, it means to say that there's two themes which are being conveyed, one verbally and one via sight, visually, which is the way we read this Megillah. So moida means to say, moida comes from what words? Leida, right? Or it's knowledge, or actually closeness. So you know, Hashem says about Avram Avinu, Ki yadativ leman asher yitzaves bono ves beis ha'achrov. Hashem says, I have a relationship with him. I love him because I know that Avram Avinu is going to carry on my legacy, my ideology in this world. Right? It's also used in the terms of intimate contact in the Torah. Vayeda adam es chava ishto. So the word over here of moida has a notion of closeness. So there's a closeness in the family between Boaz and Elimelech, which is wonderful. But the problem is that in the actual kri, the way it's written, is actually it's spelled mem yud dalad al ayin, which is, so if you break that up, it's really mi da. Does he know?
Who knows,
right? And isn't that interesting? It's almost like there's a dramatic irony over here. So she's connected to this man, and this is fabulous, and this should be everything. This should be the end of the story. And then the Megillah says visually, well, Mida, is he really connected? Because what's missing over here is the invitation. What's missing over here is the conversation, the connection. He hasn't said anything. He hasn't picked up a finger. So the Megillah itself is questioning how Moida is he in the way the text is actually written. That's what the Megillah is asking over here. Why do you think he doesn't? Why doesn't he pick up a pen? He's a Gibor Chayil. He's obviously not so far off, because we're about to meet him. His fields are clearly within walking distance.
Is he still practicing as a
shofar? It does seem like he is practicing as a shofar. We're going to get you to his status. But what's... So technically speaking, you know, he's not really the next in line over here. But you would think, you know, if I'm passing through a city and I have distant relations there, and especially if I hear the distant relations are going through a difficult time, I'll make it my first priority to make sure I connect with them. So there's something else going on over here. Maybe it has to do with... So maybe we have to put ourselves in Boaz's mind. Part of it might have been is that there's something he's scared about with the family of Elimelech, either their actions or their predicament. Meaning, maybe he's worried that whatever curse was hovering over that side of the family, he's a little worried about stepping under that cloud.
Right,
so it might be that he's with Yehuda and Shelah. We're going to see lots of parallels, the third son. So almost Boaz is like being, whoa, this is very dangerous. I don't want to step into this surrounding. Okay, and that's exactly what's going on over here, where he's sort of stepping away from continuing the legacy of a family because of his own fear. More than that, it may also be, and this is something we have to think within ourselves, is there a prejudice against Mrus just from the fact that she's from Moab? Right, and we have to think about that, because you say, well, no, she's converted, everybody loves her. But then, you know, when you actually notice the next pasuk, remember, at this point in time, we, as the reader and the Megillah, both know, so we're on the same page, that Rus, in fact, is now, what nationality is she?
She's
Jewish, which is why the pasuk says in the next pasuk, in Beis Vayomer Tomer Rus HaMoavia El Mo Anami.
But at this time, it wasn't valid.
Okay, no, but wait, she's made this step, but the Megillah nonetheless describes her as her previous culture. So what you see over here is that the Megillah is emphasizing that as much as a journey, the Hashava Mistei Moav, and she's made that journey, some people's perspective, whether the Megillah is giving us the perspective of from the outside or not, are looking at her as Rusa Moavia. Okay, so that might help us understanding the Midah. really meaning Boaz is he a Moida or is he a Mida? Who is he really connected? Is he not connected? That might be part of what's going on in that conversation, which is going to, now we have to sort of filter that through in his conversation with Rus, as we're about to see. So let's drive further into that. Well, by the way, why is that a problem? It's not just that people are xenophobic, right? This is over here. The Torah tells us, Lo sidrosh shlomam v'tovah som koyem echol olam. There's a prohibition about getting too involved with Moabites. Okay, so what from Boaz's perspective, he is thinking, look, this branch of the family goes out, spends too much time over there, they all die, they come back, they bring one of them with us. It's like, okay, just be very careful. So that might be what he's thinking over here. We don't know. But it's the text seems to be clearly questioning his involvement or lack of involvement. So now, notice that for the first time we have our proactive assertion made by Rus herself. Herself, she says the following. El Chana in Pasuk Bey is El Hasadeh, Valaktabe Shibolim. I'm going to go and collect some grains. Achar Asher Emtzachem Be'enov, Vatamela Lechiviti. So she says, you know, I'm going to go find grains and see if I can find eyes in the in his eyes or in their eyes. And she says, go ahead. Notice, by the way, that four people who are on the lower echelons of the economic spectrum, there are a number of options which are open to them. And the Torah sort of encourages that there's three particular mitzvahs which are leket, shechecha, and peah. So just to clarify the difference between them, leket is where you have the harvester is walking along and he drops a few things. So the person walking behind that person can pick up the grains if there's a certain amount. Shechecha is when they've already finished collecting the grains, they leave a bundle in the field and they forget it. They're it's the end of the day, they're bringing everything in, they leave a bunch outside. That which is left outside, the poor people are entitled to it at the end of the day. And peah is the corner of the field, which is there's a certain designated area in the field. Have a certain, you know, the way of thinking about it is almost like, it's almost like a tax requirement, right? There's a tax on every field. There's a certain percentage which is left for the kohen is given to, but the one is left for the poor people to get involved with. Out of those three, what do you think is the most violent collection? Meaning, out of those three, what is the most competitive collection? Do you think?
Like
most of the problems occur with peah. Right, most of the problems occur with peah, where there's one corn in the field, and all the poor people are converging on that, and they're all beating each other to try to get that. So notice what is she suggesting over here? She is saying it's clear that she's aware of what's going on because she's making the suggestion herself. But nonetheless, what she's asking for, she's saying, I'm going to go for leket. I'm going to go for the very gentle, running behind the person who's collecting, and the few grains here and there. It might not be as big as high stakes, but there's less involved, and the type of personality you already see is, well, I'm going to try to find favor. She's got a certain grace about her already. Before, you know, she's not in here for the double bottom line. She's here for to find favor as much as she's also bringing home for her mother-in-law. That's what the Malbim points out in her suggestion over here. Then she says, so what happens? What do you know? She goes to collect in the field, and the field she hits, boom, Vayikra Mikreah. How do you translate that? What's Vayikra Mikreah?
Just happened.
Right, Mikreah means something which is happenstance. Okay? It's the mirror opposite of what we call Hashkacha. Hashkacha is where you have Hashem orchestrating everything, and Hashem's making sure every detail comes in, and all the ducks are in line, and everything works out. What's happening over here? Look at that. Isn't that unbelievable? All the fields that she could have walked into, she walks into the field of her cousin-in-law. That's essentially what's going on over here. And that's something we're going to have to struggle with a little bit in the Megillah, is the Megillah seems to almost brush under the mat Hashem's involvement. Let's wait and see the first time the Megillah uses Hashem's involvement directly. This is not it. But isn't it interesting that the way Hashem's divine plan opens up and unfolds is left in the form of mikra. That's something which is really quite unusual, and there's a reason for that. But let's try to put mental markers into the road and saying, well, that was pretty divine. That was where Hashem was, even though the Megillah is hiding it from us for a particular reason. Okay, so she chances upon his field. Hashim Amachem, he goes to the Kotzrim and he says, God is with you. They say, God should bless you. So he evokes God in this chance setting. They respond with the blessing of God. And then he asks about her. But before we get to asking about her, let's perhaps close today with a Malbim. The Malbim suggests, actually, should we take a quick look at it inside? The Malbim is to be found on the top of page 16. The Malbim is commenting on this very unusual conversation, meaning it's not just that Boaz arrives and he's asking about Ruth. He has a greeting session with his employees. So the very top of the page says Chazal Amru Sheboazu Beis Dinoi, that Boaz and his court, because in fact he was a judge. So Boaz and his Beis Din made a decree She Yushalim Shalom Chavera B'Shem. That when greeting your friends, when greeting your contemporaries, you should evoke the name of God in that greeting. Notice how he says it, because he says, what were the words he used? Hashem imochem, God be with you, or Hashem is with you. V'hayah be'etzas ha-Sanhedrin, it was the Sanhedrin's decision or advice at the time. Skipping to the next line, v'chi tema boaz midat denavshe ovid. The Gemara asks, do you think he really did it based on his own thoughts? We know that you can't just mention Hashem's name whenever you want it. Meaning they weren't just saying Hashem. They were actually saying Hashem's real name. You can't just evoke that for no reason. He says, skipping to the next line, the third line where there's a comma is, Ach, bir oysam oz, shoya benehem gezel mishpat v'tzedek, v'gam el ha-shofteim lo shomeyu. He looked at society, and Sanhedrin looked at the society, and this is a worthy point to now zoom backwards out of. And they looked at the society, and they saw that there was a corrupt society. There was a lot of thievery, there was a lot of twisting of judgment, and they weren't listening to their own judges. Kemosha Amar, as the pasuk says, Vayibi mei shvot ha-shoftim. It was the days when the judges were being judged, meaning no, there wasn't a sense of authority that was transparent here. V'kasher nismana boaz lishofet. One of the first things he did was to say, you know, you should bring Hashem into your conversation. It's almost lehavdil. It's like, you know, a Giuliani type of, you know, you say, well, let's crack down on bribery. Let's crack down on the money laundering. He's like, no, let's bring Hashem into our conversations. Let's start bringing Hashem into our day-to-day lives. Likbar bilibam ki Hashem mishamayim mashkif aleim v'al shlomam. Because they should realize that as they're walking down the road, and they're not just in the synagogue, or in the place of worship, or in the Mishkan, God's also looking at them. And the Gemara goes along with this theme. So one of the things that we're seeing over here is that Boaz, before we get into the rest of Boaz's internal relationship with Ruth, is we need to understand Boaz from his bigger perspective. Boaz was a society fixer. Boaz was a leader. Boaz had a very interesting insight into a society which was corrupt, because up till now we haven't dealt very much with society. We've dealt with a nuclear family. This pasuk is already telling us that there's something bigger going on over here. Society is melting down. He is perhaps trying to cut the losses. Why? How? In this very unusual way, which is evoking Hashem in. It's interesting that he evokes Hashem in specifically the place where Hashem is being hidden in his plans, which is where we end. So this is a stopping point. We're now going to get into the conversation of Boaz and Ruth and the Kotzrim and try to understand agendas as to do with Ruth. Possibly right. Boaz is either at the same level or he had his own agendas. Yeah, as the townspeople. Any other thoughts while we have... Yeah, Cherry.
You kind of skipped over the fact that she called her daughter. So I think that
yes,
the fact that
good
it's
call.
The first time that it's mentioned there, that she's acknowledging that, and that kind of ties it into the family of Elimelech.
Beautiful.
The next...
Beautiful, yeah. So it's almost like the Tanakh has said, here's the family, and now she's saying, and here's the extended
right,
family.
Here's my daughter, and now here's Boaz, and here's Elimelech.
Beautiful, so. Right. So it's completing that chain.
Right.
Very well taken. You're right. In the first parak, it was daughter-in-law. Now it's become
right.
daughter. She's almost the surrogate daughter she never had.
The progression now to Boaz and Elimelech and the family.
Very well taken. Very well taken. That sort of flows from that first pasuk. Very
right.
interestingly enough. Beautiful. Very well taken.
And when learning just in Memphis, they're always saying that Ruth's, like, her modesty was something that attracted Boaz. So if he's coming from a society where everybody's all just...
That's going to be even more. That's going to be even more.
This is what attracted him to her. And this is
that's going to be even more. Yeah, I think that's very interesting because yeah, that's going to be in our conversation next week, is what makes him notice her. Meaning out of all the girls, all the boys, all the people who are going to be in this field.
So, did you say that?